Welcome to the All Souls Forum here on KKFI. I'm your host, Christina Frazier. Tonight, Speaker Paul Johnson, an organic farmer and legislative lobbyist for the Kansas Rural Center, will discuss the Farm Bill. Very few Americans farm, but as Mr. Johnson explains, the Farm Bill impacts us all in many unexpected ways. Johnson not only explains the Farm Bill in detail, but more importantly, connects the dots between the bill and the environment, antitrust laws, and the economy, all the way down to the dinner table. Johnson also has actionable ideas about how to change the Farm Bill so it serves more Americans and cuts off corporate welfare for big ag and foreign countries. This show was recorded on December 9th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church here in Kansas City, Missouri. Our show begins with the speaker's presentation, followed by a short break, and then concludes with the question and answer part of the program. Thanks for tuning in. Now let's join the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
This morning I had the privilege of introducing Paul Johnson, an organic farmer and legislative lobbyist in Kansas Rural Center from the group. Anyway, let's start this off.
Well, good morning, all. You know, if I had a Christmas wish, it would be that I was here to really talk about a comprehensive farm and food program for this country that would be a community-based system that really promoted healthy food at this point, as opposed to what we really have is a corporate-controlled agricultural system that has brought a diet around the world of salt, sugar, and fat that we really need to reorient for the health of our people and for the health of the land at this point. But be that as it may, we deal with the farm bill that is before us at this point. Farm bills are passed every 4 or 6 years by Congress, and they have tremendous impact on land use I'm going to talk about. The last farm bill was passed in 2014, and with kind of the dysfunctional Congress that we have at this point, they let it expire on October 1. And I can get into some of the details about that, but the core programs for commodity payments and food stamps and crop insurance are not impacted, but there are a lot of smaller programs for organic research and for community food systems and farmers markets and beginning farmer and stuff that expired and are going to have to be redrawn and put back into a new version of the Farm Bill. And the other timing about this is that we may well see the conference committee report come to the floor of Congress, the House and Senate, this coming week. The House passed their version of the Farm Bill middle of summer, and not surprisingly, it was done only with Republican votes, and it was pretty dreadful in many ways. It would gut conservation programs. It would put onerous further work requirements on people who need food stamps. It would basically take off any limits on subsidies to our largest farms. They get the lion's share already, you know. The Senate version was somewhat more balanced. Obviously, it had to be bipartisan to get 60 votes in the U.S. Senate. Pat Roberts and Debbie Stabenow, who's the senator from Michigan, really was the key. I mean, they worked it to get a balance there. It's pretty much the status quo with a few improvements. I mean, some minor improvements at this point, but we have, you know, really a ways to go at this point. So what is the Farm Bill? 80% of the Farm Bill is nutrition spending, and the vast amount of that nutrition spending is food stamps, which now they've labeled SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program in our country. Then 20% are the farm programs. The program for crop insurance and commodities is really geared to our largest farms. I'm going to go into that a little bit, that 80% of the benefits go to 15% of the farmers at that point. The conservation title is a little more broad-based and a little more available to it. And then you have 1% that's available for everything else that USDA does, from marketing to research to, you know. And there's some themes I'm going to try and cover in my 35, 40 minutes here with you. One is the impact that the Farm Bill has on land use in our states, far more than anything the states do at this point, the amount of money and what it does with cropland and pasture land. And it's particularly true for Kansas. 97% of the land in Kansas is privately owned. Only 3% is publicly owned. And that's the highest percentage of any state in the country at this point. You know, for Kansas, it involves about 21 million acres of cropland and about 17 million acres of pasture land. Last year in 2017, $1 billion came from the Farm Bill and farm payments to the state of Kansas. And on the Missouri side, it was about $623 million. Put that in perspective, our whole Kansas Department of Agriculture, which is kind of the driving policy for agriculture in Kansas, has a $45 million budget. $1 billion in farm payments, 45. We have a state water plan in Kansas where we're trying to deal with water issues and water that. That's less than $20 million at this point. So you can see that the money that comes through the Farm Bill is really far and greater. A second theme is how important the Farm Bill is in fighting hunger in our country. A third theme is how do the subsidies that play out for what we should be eating in our diet, and what does the Farm Bill actually subsidize for the types of food that that it supports. And this is probably the best overview policy paper that was done on hunger in Kansas. This came out in November of 2015. It's by the Kansas Health Institute. You can find this at khi.org. Basically, it says 1 in 6 Kansas households were food insecure in 2013. And households that have children, it's 1 out of 5 households in Kansas. This is the breadbasket of the world, quote unquote. And 1 out of 3 households that have single women children are food insecure, inadequate at this point. And it involves a total amount of 183,000 households in Kansas. We have 1.2 million in Kansas. And almost 460,000 Kansans are involved at this point. What's not really expressed in this article that, you know, when you talk food insecurity, it's a little nebulous. And the piece of the puzzle that we really need to debate in Kansas is affordable housing, and that really drives people's ability to feed their families at this point. And in Kansas, the last 10 years, we've lost any debate for affordable housing. That maybe a new governor, you know, with some new priorities will restart that at this point. And one of the reasons of our food insecurity is that Kansas, out of the 50 states, we're 44th in actual enrolling eligible people for the food stamp program to actually get food stamps. 31% of the people in Kansas that are eligible for food stamps aren't getting it at this point. And for summer feeding programs that a lot of schools are involved with that pick up the kids, free lunch kids during the summer that have lost nutrition access and that, Kansas has been dead last at this point. So this is a telling of food assistance, total food assistance across Kansas in 2013. And what it shows out of about $750 million in food assistance is that 70% is coming through SNAP. And so if we see curtailments by Congress or, you know, further onerous work requirements to take even more people off food stamps, then that's a critical loss. The second part of this pie that's the biggest is school lunches, school breakfasts, and that's $142 million. Dollars at this point. SNAP is $591 million. And then the third slice of this pie is the private sector. And it's about $66 million. It's about a tenth of what the SNAP program is in Kansas. And there's a lot of discussion that we'll just let the charities take care of it, that the food banks will pick it up, that we'll cover that. I don't see it at this point. And then you have senior nutrition, you have WIC, 47 million commodity programs, whatever. And we've seen a serious decline in the food stamp program in Kansas in the last 5 years. In 2013, we had a total for benefits of $471 million. Last year, we were down to $299 million, about a 46% drop in assistance. We had 141,000 children on SNAP in 2013. Today, it's 100,000. So are these kids eating? Let's hope, you know, at this point. So this is the USDA food plate at this point. This is what took over for the pyramid, if you remember that. This is an effort to give people kind of an idea of a healthy diet at this point. And half of the food plate is fruits and vegetables. And then a quarter are grains, a quarter is protein, and you have a dairy serving on the side. I mean, this is where you get that five servings of fruits and vegetables a day is what people drive for a healthy diet is where this comes about. Kansas imports 95% of all the fruits and vegetables that are eaten in our state. It's an $800 million market, and we're growing maybe 40 million of it locally at this point. On the grain side, half of the grains that people should be consuming should be whole wheat grains. And we take about 90% of our wheat that's harvested in Kansas and turn it into Wonder Bread, into white flour. And the other reality about this that really I think has to be tied in the nutrition debate is the health costs for unhealthy diets. Kansas jumped last year to 7th of the 50 states in adult obesity. 34% of the adults in Kansas are obese. And about a third of our kids are either overweight or obese. Now, when the Health Institute puts a number on this, it says for an obese adult, you add an extra $1,100 a year on the top of medical costs, top of just normal medical costs. So there's a lot of debate about, is it too costly to feed local food? Is it too costly to grow organically and give, you know, farmers a premium for their efforts? But I think if we understand the overall impact of what an unhealthy diet's doing, then some of this balances out. So that's the ideal. This is what is actually where our farm dollars go subsidy-wise. And what you'll see on this pie chart is that two-thirds of it goes for meat and dairy. And in essence, it's feed grains. That's what we're talking about, corn and soybeans primarily. 20% are food grains at this point. 15% sugar, starch, oil, alcohol. We're down to 2% for nuts and legumes. And there's our little old fruits and vegetables in the pie chart at 1%. This is the actual acreage that was put in, 2014, what's actually planted out there. And what you see out of this, it's 260 million acres nationwide for base acres here. 100 million, 96.8 is corn, 63 million is wheat, 54 million is soybeans. It's about 215 of the 260 million of the base things. And then you can see how the other 45 million are spread over a number of different items at this point. Then this chart actually talks about where the specific commodity payments went to. And what you see out of this is that in this pie chart, 46% of the subsidies went for corn, 16% for wheat, 15% for soybeans, 8% for cotton, 5% for rice, and basically 9% for everything else. So our farm bill basically subsidizes five crops: corn, wheat, soybeans, cotton, and rice at this point. And to get more specific about Kansas, and this is available at the Kansas Department of Agriculture website, it's called Kansas Farm Facts. This is a state summary of what's being planted in Kansas. And 8.5 million is for wheat, since we're the wheat state. You have 5.1 million for corn, 4 million for soybeans. You have 3 million for sorghum and about 3 million in hay ground, alfalfa, and other subsidies. And, you know, the wheat value is $1.5 billion, corn's $2.2 billion, sorghum's $700 million. What I would say about the wheat and sorghum is that those are the non-GMO crops that are of these major plantings here. We could have GMO wheat at any point, but export nations and people who want to sell our product who have said they're not interested. And sorghum has not been that. So for people who are looking for GMO-free food, looking for feed grains, looking for, you know, that's a key player at this point. So it totals about 21 million, 24 million when you add in the hay for cropland. We've done the numbers on how much, if we wanted to grow 100%, as I said, we import 95% of our fruits and vegetables. If we wanted to grow that in Kansas, how many acres would it take? How much acres of spinach and corn and blackberries and cucumbers and onions and things that we can grow in Kansas? You know, probably not bananas, probably not citrus fruit, but we could do that on 150,000 acres out of 21 million in cropland at this point. And 3 million of these 21 million acres of cropland are irrigated. So water wouldn't, you know, it wouldn't be particularly a problem. You know, there's a lot of discussion presses in that about we need to feed the world. And how are we going to feed the world? And if we get 3 or 4 more billion people? And I think the question is, what do we subsidize? What food sources are we making a priority so that we take a couple hundred thousand acres out of corn and put it into the food that we should be growing? So this is the total of farm bill spending in Kansas for the farm programs from 1995 to 2016. This data is complements of the Environmental Working Group that went to court 20 years ago to say that farm payments were open records. And so you can go in and type in your favorite farmer's name in this database to see exactly what kind of farm payments they're getting. The website for people who are interested in the specifics is farm.ewg.org to be able to pull up this data. But the reality is, for Kansas, it was $20 billion those 20 years. For Missouri, it's about $13 billion. And on the commodity side, the top 10% of Kansas farms got 73% of these payments. Top 20% got 88%. A third of our farmers that got no farm payments. On the Missouri side, the top 20% of Missouri farmers get 89% of those $13 billion payments, and 58% of Missouri farmers get no federal payments at this point. This is an issue paper on consolidation that came out from an organization called the Organization for Competitive Markets. This came out in August of 2017. And for people who are listening along or want to know, it's www.competitivemarkets.com to be able to pull this down. And it's virtually impossible in my mind to overstate how much consolidation has gone on in agriculture in the last 30 years. But, I mean, is it any different with banks or with airlines or pharmaceutical companies or, you know, I mean, this country since Reagan has basically given up antitrust enforcement, you know, as we know it. And this brief covers both the beef, the meat markets into grains. And clearly the market that was first most vertically integrated on the meat side was poultry, came after World War II. And you have a handful of companies, and let me say this, the three key companies to start with, and you have the thing, is Cargill, which is the largest privately owned corporation in the United States, Tyson, who everybody's heard of, and a Brazilian firm called JBS. That's now the largest meat producer in the thing. Our most vertically integrated meat market is poultry. It's a handful of companies that control the market. There is no free market left. The Tysons of the world, they own the whole shebang. They own the birds, they own the feed, they own the veterinarian services, they own the processing. The only thing chicken growers do is go into debt to raise birds and chicken child care for the Tysons of the world. There's about 16,000 chicken growers when you sit down with your chicken nuggets in our country, and 70% of them are at poverty wages or less. Chicken growers are putting up $250,000 single-use chicken houses to raise 30 to 50,000 birds. They're responsible for the utilities. They're responsible for any dead birds. They're responsible for all chicken litter. It's a ruthless endeavor of how the meat that's coming to our table. Kansas has no broiler production in our state. We went through a battle in Tonganoxie about Tyson and whether they were coming to town. Missouri has 42 million birds in the state. Those who want to know county-wise or where all this things, there's a website, and it's called www.factoryfarmmap.org. If you want to see where the chickens, cows, hogs, and that are raised. Second in the meat market is hogs. And we have no independent market left in hogs. 98% are either owned by the packers or are forward contracted by independent growers who have no place else to go but to get their hogs processed. And almost the vast majority of our hogs now come from large CAFOs, confined animal feeding operations of over 5,000. And the decline's been dramatic. In 1980, Kansas had 99,900 hog farms. Today, we have 10% of that left, 900, and 311 of those large CAFOs produce 95% of the hogs that in the state of Kansas. How many in this room have heard of Smithfield Foods? How many in this room know that 2 years ago, Smithfield Foods was bought by the Chinese? In fact, Missouri changed their state law so that China could buy farmland in Missouri. And Smithfield, all of China, now owns one out of the four hogs raised in our country. Do we care? I mean, you know, what is food security or insecurity? On the beef market, there are really four firms that control that. Cargill, you heard that, Tyson, heard that, JBS, and there was a rancher-owned cooperative that started up called National Beef. They got bought by a New York venture capital firm, 4 or 5 years ago. And then last year, it was bought by, hold your breath for this, Marfrig, which is also Brazilian. So half of the main four packers that do 90% of the beef in our country are owned by Brazilians. Many of the feedlots only have one buyer that to come. You know, I mean, it's not as integrated as hogs or poultry in the sense that about 70% of the cattle that move through the feedlots are either packer owned or forward contracted. So you have about 30% that are left independent, but because there's so few places to go processing, I think we're down to about 24 mega packing houses doing the vast majority of our beef. Kind of a, you know, thing. The other thing about the Brazilian firms buying this is we battled in the Farm Bill for a long time on what's called country of origin labeling, so people might know where their meat's coming from and have, you know, some consumer choice. These agribusiness corporations took that out. And with Brazil buying half of the key people processing beef in our country, a lot of this is going to be Brazilian beef coming in the United States. And once it's processed in a USDA meat plant, then suddenly it's American beef, for all consumers know at this point. People who want the best primer on the industrialization of the North American meat market is written by a former anthropology professor at KU, a man named Don Stull, S-T-U-L-L. And the name of this primer is called Slaughterhouse Blues, if you really want to know, you know, where we're headed. And if you get to this issue paper, you'll see this lists all the companies, and by the very, from soybeans to beef to pork to turkeys to, I mean, you'll get an idea of the players that are doing this. Well, I don't have any real silver bullets on how we're going to build a new food system, but I think that's where the debate needs to go. And that's what senatorial and congressional campaigns need to be about when we're debating of what we subsidize with farm bills and where we go at this point. I'm an avid beer drinker. And how many local breweries have we seen in the last 20 years that are trying to take back part of that market? The number of farmers' markets in Kansas has expanded from 80 to 120 in the last 25 years. There's a real interest in that. I was involved, started in 1994, with putting a CSA together called Rolling Prairie Farmers Alliance. It's the oldest multi-farm CSA in the Midwest and maybe the country. And so we've got 5,000 or 6,000 CSAs across the vegetable subscription services across the country at this point. I mean, for those of you old enough and remember World War II, look at the efforts that Eleanor Roosevelt made with the Victory Gardens and the millions of gardens that were put in to, I mean, this isn't rocket science on some level that we want to take back our food system. I look for parallels as a lobbyist to see, you know, where in other areas it made a difference and might we learn from that. And one I've saw in Kansas dramatically is renewable energy. And Kansas had one industrial wind farm in 2000. Today we have 24. We set a goal in 2009 under Parkinson to say we wanted 20% of our electricity by renewables by 2020. We actually got there in 2016, and last year we were at 35%. So is that comparable to say, should we set a goal in Kansas for local food consumption? Should we make it a statewide priority and set certain benchmarks and work with our small business development centers and work with our credit unions and, you know, to start building? But a key part of this has to be what's happening federally and with the Farm Bill. So if they gave me the magic wand to write the Farm Bill and the improvements that I would like to see, one is there ought to be severe limits on the subsidies to the largest farms. Now, we need to get out of that game. We need to fully fund the key conservation programs that are in the Farm Bill. CRP is the largest now. It's Conservation Reserve Program, but it's basically a 10-year retirement program. You take land out and you treat it well, and you're improving soil and doing that, but it's what it is, a land retirement. Well, what advocates in the Rural Center and folks have worked on the last couple of farm bills is a program called CSP, which is Conservation Stewardship Program, and it's for working lands. My feeling is that you pay farmers to treat the land carefully, to improve the soil, to build up soil matter, to improve that resource that's a national resource, then that can be a part of their income stream, a key part of their income stream, so they can do more diversification. So they can try other operations and niche crops and specialty crops. And good Lord, we've got to start enforcing antitrust laws. Time for a Teddy Roosevelt to arise to break up some of the monopolies that have taken over our food system. We need regional food systems. This map up here is the listing of the state meat lockers that are in the state of Kansas. There are about 80 of them. Half of them are what are called custom plants. They're inspected once a year. So if you take your hog or your cow to it, you can get it cut up, and then you can give it to your neighbors and your family and eat it yourself. The other half are state inspected, where you have the animals processed, and then you can sell at restaurants, you can sell at farmers markets, you can sell at supermarkets. The key limitation to state-inspected plants is that they can't sell across state lines, which is a whole other debacle that I could talk about later, but that's a limit. We have about 14, which is not on this map, of small, federally licensed meat plants. But we only have, out of all of these plants, the 14 federal, I think two of these plants will actually handle live birds. So you're going to bring your poultry and have it processed. It doesn't exist in Kansas. And if we don't want Tyson in Kansas, then what we want, we need to be talking about what a community-based model would look like, where the workers in that plant would own part of it, that the growers would be part of it, consumers, investors, I meant. Co-ops in Kansas are not socialist, they're not considered, we have rural electric co-ops and we have credit unions and we need some viable options to what the Tyson model is all about. So let me, and the other thing I have to say is, outside of a ballot box that you get to go to, once every year or 2 years or 6 months, to vote for policy choices, your fork is maybe your most important item. Three times a day, your fork can be your vote on the kind of food system that you want in our country. And consumers are going to have to be more active, and it's happening. They want more organic. They want less processing. They want, cleaner food. I'll end here about this is an organization. It's called the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition. The Rural Center and 150 groups across the country have worked with this for 25 years. This is our advocate in D.C. in battling on farm bill issues. This is the place where we put together our requests for the Conservation Stewardship Program, which came out of an NSAC work, beginning farmers, farmers markets, regional food systems, disadvantaged farmers. This is our advocate at the table, trying to make an impact on the Pat Roberts of the world and at that. And the website for people who are hearing this over the radio is www.sustainableagriculture.net. And they're putting out weekly, if not more so, blogs and emails about where the farm bill debate is in Congress right now. And what are, and I'll end with this thought, with the Democrats taking over the House, we're probably better off not swallowing a lame duck farm bill. But we may not have a choice in some ways in the next week or 10 days. Because if we did wait until, the Democrats would come a lot further along with what the Senate did on its side, and we'd get a better bill next year. But we'll see how this plays out. Your news, if the farm bill starts to move, you'll get some coverage on that over the next week. So I appreciate your time, and glad to answer questions as best I can.
Good morning. Thank you. I probably should know the answer to this, but I don't. So what, when you say that houses are food insecure, what does that mean?
According to the USDA, food insecurity is a household level economic and social condition of limited or uncertain access to adequate food. And I guess the way I interpret it is that the question is, what's going to be available the last week of the month for food availability for the kids, or are the parents going to be able to eat at this point? I mean, that's why I think the housing component really needs to be brought in to really give, a better definition of where the stress really is.
Recently there was a huge recall of the
yes.
hamburger.
Yes.
And
that
said to be the largest.
That was JBS.
Yeah,
yes.
Was this a particular packing house, or is this endemic in the industry? And I know USDA regulates meat. So there's a,
yes.
a conflict of interest here.
Yeah. Well, I can't say that I'm a total expert on all of that nuance. Thank you. That came out of one of the Arizona facilities, and actually it gets down to the fact that, when you've got 20 or 30 plants doing the vast amount of beef processing in our country, you're moving so many different cattle into the process that keeping track of it all, And unfortunately, a lot of the regulation in our meat plants the last 10 years has gone more and more towards self-regulation. That USDA's, been understaffed, like a lot of parts of federal government. And so it's a game of how do you stay up with 5,000 head that are being processed in a day at a plant in Garden City or, in wherever. And when you're mixing that much meat into it, if only a couple of the cattle are diseased, whatever, they don't get it, then it suddenly gets spread, then it gets spread multi-statewide for how it's distributed. Hope that helps.
So one of the things that you pointed out was how much the budget for the farm bill really is SNAP. And to even call it a farm bill at this juncture almost seems ludicrous because you're dealing with two completely separate programs that have been married. And the Des Moines Register had an article here recently calling for these two programs to be divorced. What is your opinion on separating these two so they can be dealt with individually?
Well, actually, there were a couple items I was going to mention in my notes that slipped by me, but first of all, the reason that that food stamps are in the farm bill is because of Bob Dole and George McGovern, and it was put in food stamps were piloted in the 1960s. It went into full implementation in the 1970s. It was the 77 farm bill that was it was finalized, and the reason Dole and McGovern wanted it there was because we're down to 2% of the people who are in farming anymore. How do you keep urban legislators engaged in the farm debate at this point? So that was the thinking. Now, in 96, when we saw that was the year of a farm bill. That was also the year that welfare reform passed, when the AFDC program was turned into TANF and block granted to states. And to Pat Roberts' credit, and I'll give him credit for this because he was head of the House Ag Committee at that point, the farm bill he wrote was pretty dreadful, but he said we were not going to block grant food stamps at that point. If you took it out, and you know, today it's an entitlement. If you meet certain criteria, then they find the funding for it, and that's why it goes up during recessions, and you know, it's a balancing for health and that. You block grant it, send it to the states, like TANF is in Kansas, and it'll get raided for many other things. No, I guess my feelings are that we need the nutrition programs in the farm bill, and we need the coordination for what we're producing on the farm side to get to the food side. And we need a holistic, synergistic effect that speaks to school lunch and WIC, et cetera.
Nothing will make you feel more guilty than not doing what your mother told you to do. So just about the time that I was thinking about getting back in the salad business, specifically romaine, just 2 days after that, we had the latest debacle with people getting sick and others not knowing what to do. And now they've reached some kind of a confusing conclusion about labeling where the romaine comes from.
Right.
And you're supposed to choose
track that
according to whenever is the next disaster, and you stay away from romaine from that state.
Right.
So, I mean, this is kind of complicated, I guess, and hard to track down, similar to meat, but could you comment a little bit about where we're going with that?
Well, I think that first scare for romaine lettuce came out of Arizona. And this latest one, and there's different levels of seasonality between Arizona and California, and those are really the salad bowls for the country outside of some of the stuff that we import. So and once again, it's the whole concentration effort. You know, how much romaine lettuce or other green substitutions could we be growing in greenhouses in Kansas City? And why, you know, we need the diversification and we need different suppliers at this point. I mean, it's like the damn bill that they shoved through Congress a year ago that Roberts dealt with on whether genetically modified food should be labeled. And Vermont stepped up and passed a state law that went to label GMO food. And Congress, in its great wisdom, stepped in and said, no, that's a federal issue. We're going to usurp the state's rights to do it. And they passed this, you know, amazingly complex effort where if you've got your cell phone out and you read, you know, the label on product you want to buy, they might tell you whether there's genetically modified ingredients in it or not. I mean, that's how sad, you know, consumers have a right to, you know, to know that, and they have a right to make choices. And if you're not buying USDA organic, you know, in some ways, you know, you're, I mean, 80, 90% of our corn and our soybeans are genetically modified. So for farmers to find non-GMO options is a real battle. But I mean, consumers, you know, will probably be in the driver's seat on you know, forcing more clarity on some of the information on local food. Yes?
I was curious about the soybean situation. In other words, if China owns land where they're growing soybean, are we subsidizing that?
You know, once the tariffs went down, Sonny Perdue, who's the new Secretary of Agriculture under Trump, said, "Well, we'll help bail out some of these losers. You know, some of the people who are getting caught up in the tariff war." So they passed a $12 billion. rescue package for it, and for soybeans it was like $1 a bushel. And your point is exactly right that Charles Grassley, who's a senior senator from Iowa, stepped up and said, we are subsidizing some of these foreign corporations with this bailout money.
I've been so puzzled as to why all these farmers are still backing Trump.
Well, that's a much longer story than I would venture to guess.
You've primarily been looking at the big, broad issues here. I'd like to get down to kind of individuals. We're right here on state line between Missouri and Kansas, and many of us, when we moved here or lived here, are trying to decide, should we live on the Missouri side, should we live on the Kansas side, and look at things like schools and housing costs and so forth. If one is looking at the issue of food, including what you get, what children get at the schools, what's available and so forth, what would you recommend someone look at when they're trying to decide which side of state line do we go on? How does food fit in here, and how can we try to intelligently evaluate that as an individual?
A great, great question, and you know, it's probably at the edge of my technical understanding at this point. Having not been a parent, I haven't dealt with some of the children's issues and some of those details at this point. I mean, you have a number of local food groups across the state line. You have a group called Cultivate Kansas City. You have a number of forums that's been put on at this church about, you know, community gardens, and you know, there are a number of people that are analyzing. I mean, unfortunately, sometimes it deals with affluence. And you know, I think that Johnson County is a particular strong place for more local food awareness, and building off some of that. Kansas City, Kansas is in the process of bringing a new grocery store downtown, and it's going to be a food co-op that out of Lawrence called the Merck that I've been involved with for 40 years. And there's been a lot of thinking and planning on how best to do that and integrate gardens into that. Part of the simple story is that we have a long, long ways to go to get much, you know, the kind of local food production that's really going to make a dent. And the school issue is, you know, a whole other, you know, angle to. So I'm sure I didn't answer that very well, but.
Do you see any way in which to get the industrial crops like corn and somewhat soybean out of the agricultural consideration because it's being used for alcohol and in fuels and like? Because I think what I'm seeing is that the alcohol plants are kind of going bust for some reason, for a number of reasons. In fact, they're parting them out. So do you see any way to get that out and then free up that subsidy for other parts of the farm system?
Well, I don't know if it's applicable in my lifetime. And I think a lot of it comes back to the Farm Bill. And if people weren't farming the particular crops, and if that wasn't the basis for, you know, the bankers are saying that you have this kind of crop insurance, and you know, they know how to raise soybeans and corn, and you know, it's feed corn. It's, you know, it's not sweet corn. It's, you know, whatever. I mean, that's why, you know, we need a, you know, 5 or 10 year transition period to back off of those subsidies and move it towards conservation and give people, you know, more, you know, let them plant to the market, as opposed to what we build in with the vast amount of our payments, as you saw in some of these charts, going to just a select number of crops. I mean, you know, 2 million of the 3 million acres irrigated in Kansas are in southwest Kansas, you know, and primarily to grow corn, you know, wheat, a couple other things, but, and we're draining it, you know, we're unsustainably drawing the Ogallala down out there. So there's a lot of, if we had a full cost accounting on how, you know, what the you know, and a lot more diversified grazing opportunities. And there's a lot more discussion in the agricultural circles about regenerative agriculture. And, you know, some of it's going to mean people eating less meat and changing diets, you know, so, you know, and beans and tofu and, you know, other things start incorporating. So, you know, you don't need as many animals and process. Although I think animals are incredibly important for soil condition and for, you know, improvement of organic matter and that. And I'm sure vegetarians in this room will have a debate with me about some of this. But, and, you know, once again, some of it comes down to consumer choice, too.
I've heard of that there's some place in the greater Kansas City area where they're starting a shrimp farm. And I'm just wondering what other things do you see that are a possibility for urban growing, urban food of many different kinds that we could be thinking about?
Well, I have to plead ignorance on shrimp. I'm not tuned into that. I'm a little tuned into tilapia, you know, as people grow that in tanks and they run that through greenhouses and they use the water for, you know, various purposes at this point. You know, I read Bloomberg Business Week pretty often, and they have, you know, a lot of articles about growing indoor greens operations, and you have certain, you know, with LED lighting, and, you know, with, you know, 20-foot tall growing towers, and SoftBank, you know, which owns Sprint, is putting tens of millions of dollars, and, you know, there's plans to put one of these major warehouses of these growing tubes in every city over a million people. And so, and it uses 90% less water in some of those operations. Now, obviously, being the purist I am, an outdoor gardener, you know, I wonder about, you know, exactly nutritional quality, and, you know, debate about how do you get the micronutrients into that if you're growing lettuce and spinach and basil and peat moss or in other mediums. But I mean, there's excitement about it, you know, and I think there's, you know, potential. You know, Chicago's got a couple of places that are large supermarket, you know, warehouses, indoor grow operations, outside of probably the marijuana that's grown in Chicago too. But
I would like to think that, especially young farmers starting out, but that farmers would be coming to you in droves trying to learn the methods that you've been, you know, continuing to develop over these years with your organic farming. Do you get contacts from farmers wanting to, you know, be your students?
Well, sure. There's various mentoring programs that have been started at K-State and various places, and the rural center's been involved with beginning farmer and, you know, farmer programs. I mean, the average age of the Kansas farmer is 60 years old at this point, and only 7% of the farmers in Kansas are under the age 35. So we need a different, you know, a whole new array of beginning farmers. And some of that's going to take access to financing. Some is going to take access to how, you know, can you farm and still pay your health insurance? I mean, there are a lot of things, you know, or how to, you know, can two households make it, you know, one working off the farm and having the health insurance, everything running, you know, the farm at this point. So a lot of people are talking a good game. We just haven't put the business planning, and we haven't made it enough of a political priority at the state or federal level to really say that this is a new generation that's really vital for survival of this country.
Thank you so much. I'd like to present our honorarium, the official coffee cup Union made for this speaking at the forum. Next week, we're going to have Kelly Herndon, who was unable to come to us. She was sick here a while back, speaking on keeping the EPA going amidst political turmoil. I can imagine what she's talking about. Anyway, thank you all for coming.
Thanks for listening. I hope you've enjoyed tonight's presentation, Advocating for a Food and Farm Bill with Paul Johnson. This program was recorded on Sunday, December 9th at All Souls Unitarian Universalist Church. All Souls Forum is edited and produced for broadcast by Christina Frazier. Our theme song was composed, performed, and recorded by musician Fred Potter. This program will be available for podcast within one day of broadcast on the KKFI website, kkfi.org. Remember, you can also find archived All Souls podcasts and many other interesting and enlightening public affairs programs produced by KKFI on the KKFI website. Thanks for joining us this evening, and we hope you tune in next week, same time, same place, when we will continue the conversation here at 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City's community radio station.